All right, so you've been going through Ezekiel, right? And you get to chapters 25 through 28, and it's like, whoa, all these pronouncements against Judah's neighbors. It's pretty intense stuff. So I can definitely see why you'd want to kind of unpack all that.
It's a really fascinating section, especially when you think about the historical context. You know, Ezekiel was prophesying during the Babylonian exile,
Right.
a time of just immense trauma and upheaval for the Israelites. And so these pronouncements really offer this unique window into how they viewed their neighbors during this really, really tumultuous time.
Yeah, it's almost like reading their diary during a really bad breakup. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So what's the context here? Like, why is Ezekiel so fired up against all these other nations?
Okay, so imagine this. You're Judah, and you're surrounded by all these nations that were once your allies.
Okay.
And according to Jeremiah 27:3, you find out about a plan, like a rebellion against the Babylonian Empire. And guess who's leading this charge?
Who?
Judah under King Zedekiah.
Oh, so they're the instigators.
Exactly. They're trying to stir the pot.
Okay.
But here's where the betrayal comes in. When the time actually comes to face Babylon, all these so-called allies, Edom, Moab, Ammon, Tyre, Sidon, they bail.
Oh, wow.
They all side with Babylon and leave Judah completely vulnerable.
Ouch. Yeah, that's got to sting. No wonder these pronouncements are so, like, emotionally charged.
Oh, yeah, it's raw emotion for sure.
Yeah.
Words like aha and malicious joy, those aren't just abstract pronouncements of judgment. They reflect this really deep sense of betrayal and humiliation that the Israelites in exile were feeling.
Right.
It's like Ezekiel is giving voice to their pain and anger.
So God's stepping in like as the ultimate defender.
Yes.
He's taking vengeance on those who wronged his people.
Right. And it's really important to understand what's meant by vengeance in this context.
Okay.
Biblical vengeance isn't about this like petty revenge.
Right.
Think of it more like a restoration of balance.
Okay.
God's actions are meant to uphold justice, to right the wrongs that were committed against his people, and ultimately to vindicate both himself and Israel.
So it's less about punishing for the sake of punishment and more about setting things right.
Exactly. It's about demonstrating that even the most powerful nations are accountable to a higher authority.
Right.
And this idea is woven throughout these pronouncements.
Okay.
So let's start with the shorter ones in chapter 25 against Ammon, Moab, Edom, and the Philistines. They're accused of gloating over Judah's downfall and denying God's relationship with Israel, even taking part in Jerusalem's destruction.
And they're like adding insult to injury.
Totally.
No wonder God is responding with pronouncements of judgment.
He promises to bring Nebuchadnezzar and his army against them.
Wow.
The very empire that destroyed Jerusalem is now God's instrument to bring about justice.
That's quite a role reversal.
Yeah?
It really highlights that God can use even like seemingly hostile forces to achieve his purposes.
Yes.
Speaking of which, the pronouncements against Tyre are particularly interesting.
Yes.
Why the extra attention there?
Well, Tyre was a major power at the time, a maritime superpower, known for its trade and its wealth. They were almost untouchable.
Right.
But that's where the imagery of chapter 26 comes in, the city depicted as this magnificent ship just laden with riches.
Ah, but even unsinkable ships can sink. That foreshadowing already has me hooked. What happens next?
Well, it's not just foreshadowing. Ezekiel actually uses the structure of a funeral lament to pronounce judgment on Tyre.
Wait, a funeral for a city that hasn't even fallen yet?
Precisely, it's this really powerful literary device that emphasizes the certainty of Tyre's impending doom.
Okay.
So the lament celebrates Tyre's past achievements, its vast training network, its wealth.
Right.
But then it like abruptly shifts to mourning its inevitable destruction.
That's kind of a gut punch.
Yeah.
It's like reading a eulogy for someone who's still alive.
Exactly.
But I'm curious, does the oracle actually explain why Tyre's being judged?
Well,
Chapter 26 mentions that they were gloating over Jerusalem's fall, but is there more to it?
that's where chapter 27 gets really interesting. It doesn't explicitly accuse Tyre of any wrongdoing. Instead, it focuses entirely on this imagery of the ship and the devastating consequences of its sinking.
So it's more about the spectacle of the downfall than the reasons behind it.
Exactly. It's like a masterfully crafted tragedy that leaves the audience to contemplate the deeper meaning behind this catastrophic event.
Yeah.
It's almost as if the absence of explicit accusations makes the judgment even more chilling.
You're right. It raises the question, like, what sins could be so great that they warrant such a dramatic and complete downfall?
Right.
It's like the silence itself is an accusation.
And then chapter 28 shifts the focus from the city of Tyre to its king.
So now we're getting personal. Is this where we find out what those unspeakable sins might be?
Well, the first oracle in chapter 28 directly accuses the king of pride and hubris.
Okay.
He's portrayed as claiming to be a god sitting in the seat of the gods.
Wow, that's like a direct challenge to God's authority.
Right. And the oracle makes it clear that this kind of arrogance won't go unpunished. The king's pride will be humbled by the Babylonian army, He will die at their hands, proving that he is in fact just a mortal man.
A classic case of pride before the fall.
Right.
But then the second oracle in chapter 28 takes an even more intriguing turn. It introduces this fascinating parallel to the Genesis creation story.
Yes, the oracle depicts the king as a figure like Adam. He's described as being in Eden, the garden of God, adorned with precious stones and surrounded by beauty.
So he's like this perfect being living in paradise.
Yes, but the oracle highlights that iniquity was found in him. He corrupted his wisdom and profaned his sanctuaries for the sake of wealth and power.
So he's more like a fallen angel, a being of great potential who succumbs to temptation.
Exactly. And just like Adam was driven out of Eden, the king of Tyre is cast down from his exalted position. The cherub, who was supposed to be his guardian, becomes the instrument of his expulsion.
That's a powerful image. It suggests that the king's downfall is not just like a political defeat, but a spiritual one.
Absolutely. And the detail about the cherub driving the king from the mountain emphasizes the severity of his transgression. It's a complete separation from God's presence, a cosmic exile.
It's like a twisted creation story. Instead of humanity falling from grace, it's this one individual who embodies that fall, and it makes you think about the nature of power and responsibility. Even those who seem to have it all, wealth, wisdom, authority, can be corrupted by pride and greed.
It's a reminder that true greatness lies in humility and obedience to God, and that those who exalt themselves will ultimately be humbled.
So we've got these pronouncements against the neighboring nations. They're filled with anger, accusation, and vivid imagery. But what's the overall message for the exiled Israelites? What are they supposed to take away from all this?
These oracles are primarily intended to comfort and encourage the exiles, to remind them that God hasn't abandoned them, that he sees their suffering, and that he will ultimately vindicate them.
It's a message of hope in the midst of despair.
And the summary statements at the end of chapter 28 provide a clear interpretation of these oracles. The verses about the pricking briar and the piercing thorn suggest that God will remove the hostile neighbors who have caused Israel so much pain. He will clear the way for their return to their land, where they can build houses and plant vineyards and live in safety.
So it's not just about punishment, but also about restoration.
Right.
About creating a future where Israel can flourish again.
Precisely. And this message of hope is further reinforced by the comparison to 2 Thessalonians 1. Just as Paul encouraged the persecuted Christians in Thessalonians, Ezekiel is offering a similar message of consolation and encouragement to the exiled Israelites. He's assuring them that God's justice will prevail and that they will ultimately experience peace and restoration.
It's a timeless theme.
Yes.
Divine vindication and restoration that speaks to people of faith across generations.
Absolutely.
But there's another layer to these oracles that we haven't really touched on yet, this idea of God's glory being manifested through these judgments.
Yes, it connects me to a broader theological idea that we see throughout the Old Testament. The idea that God's glory is somehow diminished when his people suffer, and that it's restored when they are vindicated.
Okay. Can you unpack that a little more?
Think of it like this. A king's glory is tied to the well-being of his kingdom. If his subjects are suffering and oppressed, his reputation is tarnished. But when justice is restored and his people are thriving, his glory is magnified.
So God's glory is on the line, so to speak, and these judgments are a way of demonstrating his power and righteousness to the world.
Exactly. It highlights the deep connection between God and his people. Their fate is intertwined with his own glory.
That's a powerful concept. So these oracles against the nations aren't just about punishing Israel's enemies. They're about comforting the exiles, upholding God's justice, and restoring his glory.
You've captured the essence of these chapters.
But there's one thing I'm still wondering about. These oracles are so specific to the historical context of the Babylonian exile. Do they have any relevance for us today?
Yeah, it's a good question. How do we bridge that gap, you know, between the ancient world and our modern experience?
Yeah.
I think one way is to focus on these like timeless themes that these oracles are exploring. Themes like pride, hubris, the abuse of power, and the consequences of turning away from God.
Mm-hmm.
These are all issues that are still relevant today, regardless of like our cultural or historical context.
Yeah, they're like those universal human struggles that just keep popping up throughout history.
Right.
But how do we actually apply those themes to our own lives?
Well, Ezekiel's vivid imagery can help us connect these ancient pronouncements to our own world.
Okay.
Take the metaphor of the sinking ship, for example.
Right, the unsinkable ship going down.
We can ask ourselves, what are the unsinkable ships in our own time? What institutions, ideologies, or systems seem invincible but might actually be vulnerable to collapse?
It's like holding up a mirror to our own society.
Yeah.
Challenging us to look beyond the surface and consider what might be lurking beneath.
Exactly. And the comparison to the Genesis creation story can also be illuminating. We can ask ourselves, how do we see the patterns of pride, temptation, and fall playing out in our own lives and in the world around us.
So it's about recognizing that these ancient stories have a timeless relevance.
Yes.
They speak to the human condition regardless of the specific historical context.
Precisely. And by engaging with these texts, we can gain insights into our own motivations, our own vulnerabilities, and our own need for redemption.
It's a reminder that these articles aren't just about ancient history. They're about us, about the choices we make, and about the consequences of those choices.
Absolutely. And as a final thought, I'd like to leave you with this question. If these chapters were written today, what modern events or figures might be cast in these roles?
That's a really interesting thought experiment.
Yeah.
Trying to imagine how Ezekiel might speak to our contemporary world.
It's a way to gain a fresh perspective on these ancient texts and their enduring relevance. It can help us to see the connections between the past and the present, and to consider how the same spiritual principles are still at work in our world today.
So to recap, these oracles offer us a glimpse into a turbulent period of history. They showcase how faith and politics intertwined in the ancient world. They're messages of judgment, yes, but also of comfort and hope for a people longing for restoration.
They remind us that even in the midst of suffering and exile, God is still at work. He is upholding justice, vindicating his people, and restoring his glory.
And they challenge us to examine our own hearts, to confront the idols of pride and power that can lead us astray, and to seek true greatness and humility and obedience to God.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Ezekiel's oracles against the nations. We hope this has given you a new perspective on these powerful and challenging texts.
And we hope it's sparked some reflection on how these ancient pronouncements can still speak to us today. We'll see you next time for another deep dive.